The title of the talk this evening is The Thought, I, Me, and Mine. Do you get Calvin and Hobbes comic strips here?
Yeah.
You do? Okay. So there is culture. Well, I rather enjoy Calvin and Hobbes, and I'd like to share with you one of the Calvin and Hobbes comic strips. If any of you don't know Calvin and Hobbes, Calvin is a little boy, and Hobbes is a stuffed tiger. And whenever adults are not in the little box in present, then the stuffed tiger is animated and alive and speaking and playing with Calvin. So in this strip, it's just Calvin and Hobbes interacting. So Calvin says, "It's true, Hobbes, ignorance is bliss. Once you know things, you start seeing problems everywhere. And once you see problems, you feel like you ought to try to fix them. And fixing problems always seems to require personal change. And change means doing things that aren't fun. I say fooey to that. But if you're willfully stupid, you don't know any better, so you can keep doing whatever you like. The secret to happiness is short-term stupid self-interest." Now, in this strip, they're talking as they're sort of going on one of those wagons over the hills and over the paths and through the woods. So they're having this long conversation. And then, as it continues on in the next little box, Hobbes says, "We're heading for that cliff." And Calvin says, "I don't want to know about it." And then there's one where they're going off the cliff. You know what I mean? And Hobbes said, and then they kerplunked on the ground, and there's stars and, you know, that kind of thing. And Hobbes says, "I'm not sure I can stand so much bliss." And Calvin, in a stunned daze, says, "Careful, we don't want to learn anything from this." The poet Rumi said, "What good is knowledge if it doesn't lift you above yourself?" Insight knowledge is not just to inform us about ourselves, about our personal patterns, but it's to lift us above those personality particularities to see a possibility that is beyond this limited self. The process of I-making and mind-making is one of the critical investigations that occurs in meditation practice. How do we do this making of I and mine on contact with our sensory experience? How do we shift from a bare experience to possessiveness and identification? Many people are surprised when they look into their minds. We can be surprised at how relentless the thoughts are. And often, when people begin a meditation practice, at some point, they come and say, "This meditation is making me worse. I'm thinking more." But really, we're just seeing our thoughts more clearly. We see our thoughts, the train of judgment, the desires, the self-concepts, more clearly than we've ever seen them before. And it can be shocking. It can be terrifying. It can be disheartening. Because most of us wouldn't want to admit to even half of our thoughts. Just imagine if the thoughts you had in the last sitting were projected onto a screen. Would you want to claim those were mine? I mean, really. Weirdly enough, most of our thoughts are about what? Ourselves. In one form or another. Drama after drama with self in the starring role. Sometimes we play the hero. Those are the thoughts that we like. Sometimes we play the victim. Those are the thoughts that make us sad or scared. Sometimes it's a comedy, and sometimes it's a tragedy. Yet it's nothing more than a cluster of thoughts. The Korean Zen master Chinuo taught his disciples, "Don't be afraid of your thoughts. Only take care lest your awareness of them is tardy." Do you know the word tardy, late? Yeah. Don't be afraid of your thoughts. Only be careful that you're not late in the awareness of them. Tardy is a word for late. Very often when we look into our thoughts, we realize that we're repeating the same story, just slight variations now and then. Maybe we improve the ending. Or we change a little part. That makes the middle a little bit more interesting. But very often, what our stories serve is little more than telling ourselves who we are. And oddly enough, we seem to find that reassuring. As if we forgot. If we didn't tell ourselves the story of our lives, what would our lives be? Who would we be? What would we be without the story? Can you imagine the vitality of that life? It's quite extraordinary, actually, even a few moments of dropping into your life without the story, just as you are. Wei Wu Wei said, "Why are you unhappy? Because 99.9% of everything you think and everything you do is for yourself, and there isn't one." As we observe our thoughts, we begin to see the conclusions that we draw about ourselves, the way the mind forms opinions, judgments, and concepts about just about everything. Sometimes we'll have opinions about things we've never even experienced, or we'll weave interpretations that are very far removed from the actual fact of things. We might experience a pain and conclude, "I'm a weak person." We might see obsessive planning in our minds and conclude that we're the controlling type. We might see tension and conclude, "I'm an uptight person." Or experience a judging tendency and decide that we're a critical person. But are we always that way? What about the other times, the times when we're quiet, when we're peaceful, when we're calm, when we're joyful, when we're serving, when we're giving, when we're just taking a walk, nothing special? Do you ever wake up in the morning and wonder, "Who am I today?" Sometimes we're wise and sometimes we're cranky. Sometimes we're brilliant, sometimes we're open-hearted, or fearful, or dull, hurried, or impatient. Which one is the real me? One of the great wisdom masters of the 20th century in India was Srinivasagadatta Maharaj. And there's a beautiful book called I Am That, that some of you may be familiar with. And there's a dialogue in there where Srinivasagadatta is asked, or in a dialogue, the student says, in a dialogue about what, who am I, the student says, "I am what I know myself to be." And Srinivasagadatta replies, "You cannot possibly say that you are what you think yourself to be. Your ideas about yourself change from day to day and from moment to moment. Your self-image is the most changeful thing you have. It is utterly vulnerable, at the mercy of a passerby, a bereavement, the loss of a job, an insult. And your image of yourself, which you're calling your person, changes deeply. To know what you are, you must first investigate and know what you are not. And to know what you are not, you must watch yourself very carefully, rejecting all that does not necessarily go with the basic fact, I am. The ideas, I am born at a given time, at a given place, from my parents, and now I am so-and-so, living at this place, married to this person, father of this one, employed by this one, and so on, are not inherent in the sense I am. How do you cough with all these things on? Are not inherent in the sense I am. Our usual attitude is of I am this. Separate consistently and perseveringly the I am from this and that, and try to feel what it means to be. Just to be, without being this or that. All our habits go against it, and the task of fighting them is long and hard sometimes. But clear understanding helps a lot. The clearer you understand that on the level of mind you can be described in negative terms only, the quicker you will come to the end of your search and realize your limitless being. Often we say, I am this, or I am that. I am a meditator. I am a teacher. I am an artist. I am thirsty. I am restless. I am healthy. I am sick. I am anxious. I am short. I am tired. I am strong. I am a woman. I am a daughter. I am a sister. I am happy. I am angry. I am sad. I am grieving. I am frustrated. We identify with our activities, with our mental states, with our roles, with our feelings, with our momentary experiences. But are we really these things? What is this I am that precedes the concept of this and of that? Can we just be without being this and that? As we look into and investigate our own minds, we'll discover what the mind simply does. How does it construct this pattern of I and mine? Without making anything more out of our thoughts, without believing the storyline, we investigate our minds and see simply the experience of body and mind and how it gets construed through the distortions of I-making and mind-making. Through the processes of possessiveness and identification, how we miss the reality of our moment-to-moment experience by being wrapped up in the story of our lives rather than the intimate encounter with our life. A great Tibetan master, Dzogchen Khyentse Rinpoche, said, "Once we recognize that thoughts are empty, the mind will no longer have the power to deceive us." Once we recognize that thoughts are empty, the mind will no longer have the power to deceive us. Too often, the entirety of our lives can seem to get reduced to an obsessive holding, that pain, that relationship, that job, that trauma, that success, that fear, that worry. We can be tightly gripping the personal content and be blinded by the density of our own dramas. Then we do not see the vastness of the silence that we abide in. Lost in our own narratives, we can become entranced with who we think that we are. Absorbed in a world of thought, we can be entertaining ourselves with our concepts and disempower ourselves to see beyond the conceptual realm. What the discursive mind can think of, can conceive of, is very limited. Can we allow the space to know something beyond the limited range of the discursive mind? When you become aware that you've been preoccupied with thinking, ask yourself a simple question. Are these real or are they just thought? Because sometimes we attribute more reality to our thoughts than they merit. We believe them. So I think of my sister. Is that my sister or is it a thought? If I think of a dinosaur, is there a dinosaur here or is that just a thought? Seems a little absurd with a dinosaur, but if I think of a problem, is the problem here, or is it just a thought? Rather than just quickly return to the breath when the thought arises, now I would suggest that you, for a brief moment, really clearly realize the experience of being lost in thought. Use that moment to be very clear about what that is. It can be brief, but there can be a decisive moment of investigation to know that that is actually what's happening, thinking. And you can be a little bit more precise if you like and know not just thinking, but know, is it planning? Is it remembering? Is it fantasizing? Is it worrying? Is it analyzing? Is it remembering? You don't have to go into all the details, but very often we really do know, oh, this is judging, or this is remembering, or this is ruminating, whatever the kind of thought is. Know what is actually happening and really know the experience of thinking. What is a thought and how are you seduced by them? What is so intriguing that calls you, that pulls you out of the present moment to be lost in a drama in your own mind? What is so intriguing about that thought? It's really worth looking into what the hook is, what's seductive about it, what pulls us away. Because you all come to this retreat, I don't think, did you sign up here so that you could spend lots of time thinking? Maybe you don't have enough time to think in your daily life. Here, I'm not suggesting that you stop thought. I'm suggesting that you look into thought itself instead of the content of the thought. Look into the process of the thought instead of the content of the thought. Know your thought and know your reaction to that thought. There's a traditional teaching story relating to thoughts and our reactions to thoughts, which is of a monk who was an artist, and he lived in a cave, and he liked to paint images on his cave wall. And so he would meditate and paint a little and meditate and paint a little and meditate and paint a little. And he was painting an image of a tiger to decorate his wall. And he was quite a realistic painter, quite skilled. And he kept painting away and painting away. And just as he was approaching the finish, putting the finishing touches on the tiger's eyes, he stepped back to kind of, admire his work. And he screamed and went running out of the cave. He believed his own creation. he frightened himself by something that he fabricated. How often do we frighten ourselves with nothing but our own thoughts? How often do we startle ourselves with nothing but our own thoughts? How often do we make ourselves quite sad with nothing but our own thoughts? We can work up a lot of emotion based on the only thing happening as a few thoughts floating through the mind. So when we look into thoughts, one of the things we see is that thoughts change, and they change very rapidly. It's not possible that you can have a thought last for a 45-minute meditation period. It's just not possible. I'll bet you won't even be able to have a thought last for 5 seconds. Thoughts change very, very rapidly. In fact, the Buddha said that there was nothing that changed as quickly as a thought. Sometimes we notice this change by how quickly the topics change. And I used to be very entertained by my mind, but not just entertained by the content. I actually found the content of my mind particularly boring and repetitious. I used to set a limit that I would only allow the topic. I don't watch movies 3 times. Why should I watch thoughts 3 times? So 2 was my limit. On the 3rd, I pressed stop. But what was intriguing me was that some of the times I would obsess about a thought, really obsess about it, you know, just go round and round really quickly. And then I would change topics to something totally different and obsess about that one. And then obsess about the next one. And then obsess about the next one. And if the topic, if the content was actually so important, why could I switch topics so easily and obsess about the next thing? I found the content to be very unimportant. And it was essential to just look into the energy itself of thinking. So much of thinking does little more than tell me my story, the story of who I am, the story of what I did, the story of what I want to become. And it's the grip on this story of me that the investigation of thought loosens. And it helps us to loosen our entanglements in the thought world. I hope as you look into your mind, you can maintain a sense of humor. You'll need it. We all do. The content of our thoughts is not very important in a meditative approach to thinking. We experience thought instead as a wave, as an energetic force, as a habit, as a pattern. Until we see how we invest the stories in our thoughts with the belief that this is who I am, this is really me, rather than just see it as a fiction, a story, we'll be lost in that drama. It's like going to the movie theater and getting so absorbed in the drama that we think it's really happening to real people. But a film of a storm will not leave the movie screen wet. And a drama about bandits is not going to leave bullet holes in the theater walls. And a romance is not going to have those two people living happily ever after. We forget that it's a fictional representation. We get seduced into the story again and again. So in meditation practice, we broaden the sense of who we are beyond our personal content and experience the touch of something vaster than my stuff, my issues, my past, my future, my desires. Dilgo Khyentse Rinpoche said, however strong thoughts may seem, they are just thoughts and will eventually dissolve back into emptiness. Once you recognize the intrinsic nature of the mind, these thoughts that seem to appear and disappear all the time can no longer fool you. Just as clouds form, last for a while, and then dissolve back into the empty sky, so deluded thoughts arise, remain for a while, and then vanish in the voidness of mind. In reality, nothing at all has happened. I know there are times when you are very aware of thoughts and aware of the turnings of the discursive mind. In many of the group interviews, people have reported lots of thinking. I know you're aware of these thoughts. Are there also moments when you're aware of the absence of thought? Perhaps the space between two thoughts. It may be a brief moment when the mind is lucid and clear, simply wakeful and aware, and there's no proliferation of thinking. These glimpses beyond the conceptual mind occur in meditation. They may also occur outside of the formal meditation, as you're slicing a potato during your work period. They can occur as you're just taking a walk, as you're taking a shower, as you're waiting in line for the meal. They can occur outside of the retreat context, while you're standing and waiting for a bus, while you're looking out the car window, while you're drinking a glass of juice in your backyard. They may occur in the context of formal practice or in a context that is apparently without any spiritual focus whatsoever. These uncontrived glimpses beyond the discursive mind give a taste of the freedom that's possible. A freedom that is undefined by the movements of mind that try to grasp what can actually never be grasped and hold what can actually never be held and possess what can actually never be possessed. When we do not see this fundamental fact of emptiness, we lose ourselves in the movie of life, grasping after things that we desire and avoiding things that we dislike. Gunjiji used to describe it as being like a wave. He said, on the vast ocean, waves appear. If we take ourselves to be the wave, thoughts appear. If we take ourselves to be the thought, if we get involved in that trauma, we could fear that we'll be crushed as we approach the shore. Now he would tell a little cute story about the wave being afraid as it rises up and rises up and approaches the shore to crash down on the shore. But actually this wave is never separate from ocean. It's never not ocean. We are never separate from the truth. So notice the thoughts with mindfulness, the thoughts that seem to divide us from the fact of things. But also notice those moments of the freedom from the preoccupation with thoughts, those moments of silence, of quiet, when the mind stills, even if it's very briefly. Thoughts are only concepts, yet there is a knowing beyond the rise and fall of these concepts. beyond what words can describe or what the intellect can grasp. The Buddha gave quite a few names to point to the unconditioned, because no single word could possibly describe it. And I'd like to read just a few of these words, because they point beyond definition, beyond the defining limits of language. It's from a sutta called the 44 Names. And it just lists the names. The cessation of greed, the cessation of hatred, and the cessation of delusion is the unformed, the unconditioned, the end, the taintless, the truth, the other shore, the subtle, the very hard to see, the unweakening, the everlasting, the undisintegrating, the invisible, the undiversified, peace, the deathless, the supreme goal, the blessed, safety, the exhaustion of craving, the wonderful, the marvelous, non-distress, the naturally non-distressed, nibbana, non-affliction, non-hostility, the fading of lust, purity, freedom, independence, the island, the shelter, the harbor, the refuge, and the beyond. The exploration beyond the realm of concepts asks us to venture into unknown territory, where we may not find the confirmation of me and my story. I invite you to drop all concepts, to release the burden of the concepts of the past, memories, and all the fascinating or painful things that we've done. I invite you to drop the concepts of future, and free yourself from the burden of your brilliant plans, your great ideas, and the fantasies you cherish. I invite you to drop the concepts of self, your self-image, the way we embellish our personalities and personalize our experience. Consider dropping ideas of what we think our experience should be like, what our day should be like, what the weather should be like, what the food should be like, what other people on this retreat should be like, what the retreat should be like, what the teachings should be like, what the instructions should be like, what the beds should be like, what the showers should be like. Drop all concepts, all comparisons, all demands that we place on how our momentary sensory experience should be known. And enter the unknown, which is the present moment, free of all concepts, unburdened by the past, unadorned by self-image. Even drop the concept of what non-conceptual realization might be like. Drop the concept of what emptiness might be like. Drop the concept of what awakening might be like. Because, in fact, we don't know. Tsongkhapa, a great Tibetan yogi, said, "Enlightenment turned out to be the opposite of what I had expected. Let's sit